have on your skeptical radar. Pseudojournalism can take many forms, from opinion masquerading as fact to fabricated sources to advertorial sponsored content to outright plagiarism. In essence, pseudojournalism is any written content that flagrantly ignores media ethics but attempts to pass itself off as legitimate news. The most pernicious forms of this so-called fake news are easy to spot. They push a heavy agenda, come from disreputable outlets, or try to sell you something. They may tell you who to vote for. However, more subtle forms of misinformation are just as common. The idea that we're living in a, quote, post-truth era took off in 2016, making it the top pick for the Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year. Right on its heels, though, and perhaps a contender for Phrase of the Year is, quote, fake news. Fake news is clearly a thing. There are obviously websites that make up fake news stories for various purposes. It is simultaneously a bug and a feature of the internet that it's a venue for a war of ideas. There is an obvious benefit to this in an open society: the free exchange of information in the marketplace of ideas. Let's hash it all out with a true democracy of expression and access, well, for those with access. The bug is that the internet is also a venue for fraud, lying, misinformation, and manipulation. Not everyone is a fair player, and they ruin it for everyone else. And it's not black and white. Rather, there is a spectrum of behavior, and most people are at various points along that spectrum on different issues. At the same time, there are extremes. Some sites that aspire to a high level of journalism or scholarship, and at the other end, sites that are pure fraud, propaganda, or clickbait. We are collectively still trying to figure out how to deal with the resulting mess. It seems to me that part of the problem is that we're using the internet to address the problems of the internet. Bad actors can therefore hijack or duplicate the mechanisms of quality control and subvert them. The concept of fake news was introduced as a method for sorting through news outlets. It was instantly subverted for nefarious purposes and is already waning in usefulness. Essentially, a fake news site can just say, oh yeah, well you're a fake news site. Ideologues can make their own list of fake news sites, which are just their ideological opponents. The term becomes a weapon rather than a tool. We have seen this before in other contexts. The term skeptic, and in fact the format of skeptical analysis and debunking, has been hijacked by science deniers pretending to be skeptics, tarnishing the brand and sowing confusion. Characterizing news outlets. Messy reality doesn't comport well with our desires for easy categorization. Anything we try to categorize will have features that exist along a spectrum and may occur along various spectra simultaneously. This creates three intellectual pitfalls: the false dichotomy, the false continuum, and the demarcation problem. See these entries in chapters 10 and 22 on logical fallacies in pseudoscience. Where do we draw the line between real news and fake news? We must often be content with a fuzzy line and a fractional definition. There are a number of features of fake news, such as lack of vetting of sources and failure to check facts. The more of those features you have, the more fake you are. And beyond some fuzzy, hard-to-define point, the demarcation problem again, it is legitimate to call something fake news. Some individual features have such a dramatic impact that you can make a clear designation. Let's take scientific journals as an example. They exist along a spectrum of quality, but some journals do not carry out any real peer review, and some don't seem to have any editorial filter. Some journals, in essence, are fake or broken. Their primary purpose is to make money, not to disseminate quality science. In other words, there may be some black and white qualitative differences among outlets that allow for clear categorization as fake. With all this in mind, let's take a look at the fake news controversy. Clearly, a simple dichotomy, fake news versus real news, isn't sufficient to cover the range of what's out there. To start, you need an understanding of the various types of news outlets. Traditional journalism. These sources consider themselves real journalists and hold themselves ostensibly to some journalistic standard, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, etc. Their purpose is to report news, and they at least try to follow journalistic traditions. Within this category, there is a spectrum from great journalism to horrible journalism, essentially a spectrum of quality. Biased or ideological journalism. These are sites that have the format of traditional journalism, but have a clear ideological bias or agenda. This is a spectrum orthogonal to quality, the degree of ideological bias. It's probably best to consider all news outlets as biased to some degree. All people have biases, and news organizations are made of people. Along this continuum are news outlets that make a sincere effort to be ideologically neutral or at least balanced. They may lean toward one political perspective, but at least they try to keep their biases in check. Further along the continuum are news outlets that have a clear and open political bias, but make a sincere effort to work within a framework of reasonable journalistic quality. Even if they're liberal or conservative outlets, they are trying to be journalists first. This category slides seamlessly into outlets that prioritize their political agenda above journalistic quality. They blatantly select the news they choose to report and the spin they put on that news based on the political narrative to which they are catering. At some fuzzy point, they cease to be real journalists. They're no longer selling news, but selling a narrative they call the news. Opinion outlets. There are websites, journals, and newsletters that are not news at all, and don't pretend to be, but a venue for commentaries and opinion pieces with a clear ideological, political, religious, philosophical, or social agenda. They are generally upfront about their agenda, as the point is to promote said agenda. Satirical news. The Onion is the best example of a satirical news outlet. This isn't news. This is pure entertainment. They make no attempt to fool the public about their satirical nature. Their articles are obvious satire and humor. Despite that, sometimes the humor is subtle enough that Onion articles can be shared as if they're real. There are a number of hilarious instances of world leaders and governments repeating Onion articles as if they were news. In 2012, for example, the Chinese government media took seriously an Onion article proclaiming North Korean leader Kim Jong-un the sexiest man alive. There is a range of quality here as well. Some satirical sites just aren't that funny. And without the humor, they become increasingly difficult to distinguish from real news outlets or those pretending to be. In other words, there is a demarcation problem between bad satirical news and fake news. Fake news. Fake news outlets simply make up their news stories. They have no genuine journalistic process or mechanisms of quality control. Their stories are made-up fictions in the format of real news, optimized for clickbait. They're meant only to push emotional buttons in order to motivate clicks. Sometimes those emotional buttons are political. They may call themselves satire as a whitewash, but the articles are not meant to humorously expose some aspect of society or human nature. Social media. Through social media, articles are often detached from their source, and therefore from their context, and are spread as individual isolated units. Articles from all the above categories and ranging over the various spectra of quality, sincerity, and bias are dumped into a single bucket and mixed together. An article comes up on your feed, and it's up to the reader to discover the source and assess its nature and quality. Most people just read the headlines and perhaps the attached blurb, but don't have the time or inclination to do a thorough investigation. There are sites that curate news for you, but that simply adds another layer that can fall into any of the categories above. However, you only have to do a deep evaluation of the news aggregator once, and you may find a reliable one that can at least filter out the fake, blatantly biased, or low-quality news. In the end, any news you care about needs to be sourced and further checked against multiple different sources to average out the biases as much as possible. It's also good social media hygiene not to share or spread news that you haven't vetted yourself. If there isn't time to do a reasonable investigation, fine. But it stands to reason that one shouldn't share an article as if it's valid news when you have no idea. But of course, people exist along the same spectra as news outlets. People also have blogs and Facebook pages. So we're all at various times playing different roles in the news cycle. We may be curating news, sharing news, and writing articles. We are all becoming journalists, aggregators, curators, and consumers at the same time. There is no simple solution to all of this. It's a true, if at times glorious, mess. The only real solution is for each individual to be a savvy and skeptical reader. Echo chambers. Added to the concept of fake news is that of the echo chamber. The idea here is simple. We have a tendency to seek out opinions that are in line with our existing worldview and beliefs. This is like confirmation bias on steroids, not only seeking out facts that support our beliefs, but sources of information that are more likely or even certain to confirm those beliefs. People have perhaps always done this, but the internet and social media make it much easier, even the default. There are the aforementioned websites that aggregate or curate news for you. While this is convenient, it also puts a lot of power in someone else's hands. There's a lot of news out there, and a lot of different takes on the news. If, from this massive pile, only the news and opinions that support a particular worldview are chosen and fed to you, that can have a powerful effect on your view of reality. Some social media outlets do this automatically, with the intention of giving you what you want. So, if you consume a certain type of news, it will feed you articles and videos that match those preferences. You may not even realize you're looking at the world through this one perspective. There are also sites dedicated to one topic, such as belief in a particular conspiracy or an anti-vaccine agenda. Such advocacy sites say they're there that people with similar views can exchange thoughts and ideas without worrying that they will be ridiculed or attacked. While this sounds innocent enough, in practice it means that members are shielded from any disconfirming facts or ideas. Anyone challenging the basic assumptions of the group is branded a, quote, troll, and will likely be banned. The tools exist to easily maintain the intellectual purity of the group. Astroturfing. In a 2015 TEDx talk, Cheryl Atkinson spoke about the problem of astroturfing, but she wasn't aware that her talk had fallen victim to the very problem she was discussing. Astroturfing is essentially fake grassroots activism. Companies and special interests create nonprofits, Facebook pages, and social media personas, write letters to the editor, and essentially exploit social and traditional media to create the false impression that there is a grassroots movement supporting some issue. The key to astroturfing is to conceal who is truly behind these fronts. Atkinson, a journalist for CBS News, cites several examples in which pharmaceutical companies secretly promoted their drug and marginalized criticism. She correctly points out how campaigns of doubt and confusion can work by generating so much controversy that the public loses confidence in the science, and in fact science itself, and throws the baby out with the bathwater. Atkinson, however, gets some things profoundly wrong, herself falling victim to astroturfing without realizing it. At one point, she uses as an example of astroturfing what she considered pharmaceutical companies' burying of evidence that there is a link between vaccines and autism with fake studies and fake opinions. This may seem surprising for a CBS reporter, but it makes more sense when you know that Atkinson has had anti-vaccine views for many years. She concealed her own agenda, making her reporting on the issue seem like genuine journalism when it was in fact advocacy. What this shows is that once information itself is called into question because of bias, astroturfing, denialism, or pseudoscience, it then becomes easier to see reality through the lens of your preferred narratives. One person's astroturfing is another person's skepticism. It's like the movie Inception. Once you can't trust reality, there is no way to confidently know how many layers deep you are in the dream. This is why scientists and skeptics who are trying to communicate controversial science to the public are so frequently met with the shill card, using the knee-jerk accusation that they are shilling for industry as a way to dismiss their scientific opinions. It's now a common game on Facebook, blogs, and other social media outlets to count how many comments go by on a post about a controversial topic before someone plays this card. The answer is always not many. If you are, for example, an anti-vaxxer, then it's likely part of your narrative that any scientist or opinion writer who expresses a pro-vaccine opinion or counters any of the misinformation generated by the anti-vaccine movement is by definition a shill and part of an AstroTurf campaign. The existence of real AstroTurf campaigns just makes the accusation seem more plausible. Similarly, the existence of real but small conspiracies lends fuel to the conspiracy theorists who weave outlandish grand conspiracies. Atkinson ends with her advice for the public on how to recognize an AstroTurf campaign. To paraphrase, she says that the use of words such as quack, crank, pseudoscientist, or conspiracy are all red flags for an AstroTurf campaign, as is voicing skepticism towards those who criticize authority. This advice, however, paints with such an absurdly broad brush that she essentially covers the entire skeptical community. Perhaps this is intentional on her part. She's been criticized for her anti-vaccine views, and now she has a plausible-sounding reason to dismiss all of this criticism. She is just a victim of alleged astroturfing. This is especially disappointing for a journalist. Investigative journalists should know that stories are often not what they appear to be, and that this can cut both ways. There is no easy way, as an individual, to deal with astroturfing. It takes digging. But first you have to realize that Atkinson framed the question as a false dichotomy. Is it real or astroturfing? The actual choice is between real science, astroturfing, and pseudoscience. When you add the third possibility, you have a better chance of digging deep enough to know which side of a controversy has the solid evidence and arguments. While it's not safe to assume that every grassroots movement is exactly as it appears, you also shouldn't assume that accusations of being an astroturfer or a shill are legitimate. For example, the modern skeptical movement as a whole has a history that goes back at least to the 1960s. Many of the current organizations have been in existence for years or even decades. They are led by people who have very public lives. It should be a trivial matter for anyone with investigative skills to find out that I am a real person with an academic appointment who has been a science and critical thinking advocate for decades. Further, there isn't the tiniest shred of evidence that I am a shill for anyone. Anyone accusing me of this is doing it thoughtlessly as a knee-jerk because it serves their narrative, or deliberately because they care more about their ideology than the truth. The best solution for all of us is to apply a high degree of critical thinking and skepticism to any issue. This isn't easy, but it is necessary. Of course, Atkinson and others can just argue that this book is an astroturfing attempt to disguise astroturfing and criticize those who are trying to expose astroturfing. You can always argue that the dream goes one layer deeper. Chapter 47. False Balance. In science, fact can only mean confirmed to such a degree that it would be perverse to withhold provisional assent. I suppose that apples might start to rise tomorrow, but the possibility does not merit equal time in physics classrooms. Stephen Jay Gould. I have been interviewed as the, quote, skeptical voice for numerous TV documentaries. For one program about demonic possession, I was concerned that the producer was giving a lot of time to people I felt were dangerous cranks. They were claiming that mental illness is often due to possession, and that the treatment should be exorcism. I patiently explained why this was nonsense, and harmful, and encouraged them to focus on the science. The producer's response was that they were going to portray both sides and let the audience decide. They also stated that if anyone believed the proponents of demonic possession, they were stupid and deserved what they got. This was a dramatic example, among other things, of what we call false balance. The premise of false balance is innocent enough. In fact, it carries with it a good measure of utility and virtue. Before the phrase fair and balanced became an ironic media slogan, it meant something. Just like science, journalism carries with it a great deal of ethical responsibility. In journalism, that responsibility is, of course, to the reader and not the source. The purpose of a free press is to inform the public, to keep them abreast of the goings-on in their community, their government, and beyond. In an effort to minimize editorializing, allowing a journalist's own opinions and interests to find their way into his or her writing, there is a constant attempt at balance and fairness. If a fight breaks out on the street between two men, and the reporter tasked with covering it presents only one man's take on what happened, that is hardly a balanced story. And if that same story presents hearsay or unsubstantiated claims as truth, it's neither balanced nor fair. It is generally required that all sides of an argument receive some mention in a news article, and that only substantiated, corroborated facts are reported as such. This approach is especially necessary when covering political news, where there are usually two or more views on any topic. That's because politics is full of opinion and value judgments. Science, however, is mainly concerned with verifiable facts. There may be a range of scientific opinions on a topic, but those opinions are rarely balanced. For most scientific topics, the evidence and the consensus of scientific opinion is asymmetrical, favoring one school of thought over others. A good example is the climate change coverage. Say a new study is published in a peer-reviewed journal showing that last year was the hottest year on record. A television news show wants to cover the story, but the editorial staff is faced with a problem. Do they invite only the author of the study onto the show to discuss why climate change is such a problem and what steps could be taken to mitigate its effects? This would certainly be a fair approach, as it would provide unbiased, evidence-based content for the show's audience. Or should the producers invite the author of the study to sit across from a climate change skeptic, what we might fairly call a climate change denier, to fill the airtime with a back-and-forth about whether or not global warming even exists? This may be seen as a more balanced approach, but it's not a fair or scientifically accurate one. Nonetheless, this is the approach selected time and time again by professional news organizations. They've fallen into a trap known as false balance, in which they give equal coverage to sides of a story that clearly don't have equal credibility. It happens when Jenny McCarthy sits across the table from a CDC scientist, and when Ken Ham argues with Bill Nye about evolution. It's one thing to report the news. If an important public figure makes a statement that's in opposition to reality, it should be printed. But not without context. And not without the necessary fact-checking and presentation of opposing evidence to show just why such a statement is untrue. This is when balance and fairness work for the good of the people, but when Deepak Chopra has a seat at the table with Sean Carroll or Brian Greene, that's false balance run amok. As mentioned previously, anthropogenic climate change is an established fact. Surveys show that the vast majority of scientists agree that it is happening, and the probable outcomes are mostly bad. So on an episode of his weekly comedy program, Last Week Tonight, John Oliver approached this problem by welcoming 97 climate scientists to come on the show to debate one very lonely climate denier. As expected, hilarity and chaos ensued. There is more advancement on the horizon. In 2014, the BBC published a progress report on their science reporting, instructing their journalists not to interview cranks or science deniers just to provide false balance in their science reporting. Let's hope that approach catches on. Chapter 48, Science Journalism. For it is the natural tendency of the ignorant to believe what is not true. In order to overcome that tendency, it is not sufficient to exhibit the true. It is also necessary to expose and denounce the false. H. L. Mencken. Good science journalism is extremely challenging. Part of this comes from an essential tension between the very things it is named after, science and journalism. Science proceeds slowly and cautiously, is very conservative in its claims, and is skeptical toward any new findings, or at least it should be. Journalists, however, want an exciting new and simple story. In fact, bad science journalism sounds much closer to self-help gurus than to actual science. Do X and you will be happy. I know that journalists often don't write their own headlines and that there is a circle in skeptical hell dedicated to headline writers where they are tormented by the twin demons hype and sensationalism. To be fair, I also understand that we live in the real world, where ratings and clicks matter to the bottom line. This has been made very clear to me since I have been running my own science Facebook page, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I've posted 6 to 8 science and skeptical news items per day, adjusting variables and seeing directly how much reach each post gets. What is absolutely clear is that there's a direct relationship between the number of clicks and the likes an item gets and several specific variables. How controversial or emotional the subject matter is, how exciting the news item is, how clickbaity the headline is, how simplistic the message is, and the presence of cats in any form. Memes do the best, an interesting picture with a punchy sentiment. Infographics are also popular, as are lists. These are all ways to make information bite-sized and easily consumable in a fast-paced world and in a medium with a lot of competition for eyeballs. Don't worry, I haven't succumbed to the dark side. My lightsaber glows a reassuring hue of Arctic blue. The purpose of my Facebook page is not just to be popular, but to promote science and critical thinking. I have also discovered there is another way to be successful, but it takes a lot of thoughtful, hard work. It's possible, but very challenging, to present interesting science news items in a compelling way that sparks interest without compromising scientific or skeptical integrity. The fact is, science is damn exciting. You can convey this excitement while putting a story into a proper scientific perspective. Take the 2016 news item of the discovery of a possible 9th planet. What is more exciting than that? Another planet in our solar system, 10 times the mass of Earth. It hasn't yet been confirmed. The claim is based on a computer model of the gravitational effects of known objects in the Kuiper Belt. Despite the complexity, saying we may have discovered a possible 9th planet in our solar system is an interesting and accurate headline and was widely shared on social media. The real challenge for news outlets wanting to attract clicks comes on slow news days or when reporting wonky articles that are fairly dense and esoteric. We know that there are exciting scientific breakthroughs happening every day. So why is the standard for science journalism so low on average? I think this is partly due to the fact that most journalistic coverage is mediocre, almost by definition. Still, a profession can maintain high general levels of quality, and it would be nice to see higher standards for science journalism. Part of the problem is that journalists are trained to ask certain questions like, why is this important, and why should people care? When they are reporting science, this leads them to common tropes. Every basic science advance dealing with cells apparently might one day lead to a cure for cancer. Every tiny bit of knowledge about viruses might cure the common cold. And now every metamaterial discovery will result in an invisibility cloak. When in doubt, make the closest possible analogy to some iconic science fiction technology, or in a pinch, a superhero power. Physicists, it would appear, are all working on tractor beams, transporters, and warp drive. Sometimes a scientific discovery is interesting because it's a new discovery, not because it will lead directly to some tangential technology. The recent disruption of traditional journalism by social media has created real challenges for primary journalism. It's less common for news outlets to have dedicated specialist reporters, like trained science journalists. They are more likely to have general reporters covering the science beat and reporting to generalist editors. This is a recipe for disaster, because their background probably doesn't give them the tools to handle complex science news stories. Is science reporting really this bad, or is it just confirmation bias? Well, in a 2008 study, Gary Schwitzer from the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication published an analysis of 500 medical news stories over the previous 2 years. He found that in our evaluation of 500 U.S. health news stories over 22 months, between 62 and 77% of stories fail to adequately address costs, harms, benefits, the quality of the evidence, and the existence of other options when covering healthcare products and procedures. This high rate of inadequate reporting raises important questions about the quality of the information U.S. consumers receive from the news media on these health news topics. About two-thirds of all medical news stories, and these are from the top news outlets, had major flaws. In my opinion, this establishes that there is a systemic problem with the quality of medical news journalism in the U.S. Other countries have similar problems, and I suspect that poor quality is an issue across science news reporting and not isolated to medical news. It's tempting to blame the reporter for bad science journalism, but reporters are not the only source of the hype and sensationalism distorting the science. A 2012 study of medical science news reporting found that the article abstract, written by the scientists themselves, had positive spin 41% of the time. Scientific articles with such spin were far more likely to produce press releases with misleading spin and therefore hyped science journalism. So, much of the time, the buildup originates with the scientists or the press release. I have been involved at every step of this process and seen it happen. In order to improve the quality of science reporting, everyone in the chain needs to be engaged, and they need to communicate well. Scientists, for example, could use more training in how to communicate with reporters and the public. The worst experiences I have had were when reporters or TV producers had essentially already written their piece. They decided what the story was, the one that sells, and were now just interviewing experts in order to mine them for quotes they could backfill into their narrative. Sometimes the challenge for me was to find out what that narrative was, and to see if I could get them to question it and change it if necessary. Otherwise, I was just going to be quoted out of context to serve a sensationalist account. At other times, journalists may ask extremely leading questions, putting words in the mouths of their experts. Scientists have to learn not to fall for this. Even if it sounds almost right, the reporter is likely just looking to justify a sensational angle. You need to say, "No, that's not accurate. I would put it this way." Then give them a bite-sized quote they can use. Give them a long lecture, and they will just ignore it. How to vet a science news story. In addition to a generally skeptical approach, there are some specific things to keep in mind when reading science news stories. Who is the reporter and what is the outlet? Specifically, is this someone with a history of good science journalism, or were they likely covering the dog show last week? Is the outlet known for high editorial standards or clickbait? Is the news article just a press release? It's easy now to simply aggregate science press releases and present them as news, without any editorial process or investigation at all. Does the article focus on the tiny bit of speculation at the end of the study and run with that? Researchers will often round off a study with comments about directions for future research or possible implications of their research, and it is not uncommon for journalists to present this speculation as if it's the result of the study. Ask the question, what do the data in this study actually say? If you don't fully understand that, then there is likely something missing from the reporting. Did the journalists put the science news story into context? Is this a mainstream or minority opinion? What is the power of this one study? Are there other studies that come to different results? Does this actually change our thinking in this area? What are critics saying about the results? Did they talk to experts who didn't publish the study to see how the scientific community looks at it, or did they just let the researchers toot their own horns? Every event or study in science is part of an unfolding, messy process. Journalists should report the process, not the study in isolation, as if all by itself it fully establishes its conclusions. Is the journalist exaggerating our prior ignorance or the impact of the study? As in, we knew nothing and now scientists have finally solved this enduring mystery. Or are they exaggerating how new or mysterious the findings are? Scientists are baffled. And as discussed previously, is the reporter presenting false balance, or are they fairly representing the consensus of opinion among scientists? It takes a little time and effort to properly vet a science news item. It helps to have sources you can trust, but it's also a good idea, if you care about the science, to track your way back to the original sources and do a little digging. At the very least, don't take the reporting at face value. While there are excellent science journalists out there, there is also a system of poor quality control and perverse incentives. The system rewards, at least in the immediate term, sensational journalism and clickbaity headlines. It takes true dedication to quality to eschew these quick tactics for a loftier long-term goal. There may never be a real solution to this inherent problem. However, the more consumers demand quality, the better that balance of incentives will be. In turn, the demand for quality reporting is driven by quality journalism itself. It's also my hope that scientist bloggers using social media to communicate quality science reporting will move the entire system in the direction of a higher standard. Chapter 49. Enter the Matrix. There are many ways in which journalists can mislead a reader with science. They can cherry-pick the evidence or massage these statistics. They can pit hysteria and emotion against cold, bland statements from authority figures. Ben Goldacre. The Sunday Mirror declares, "Scientists develop matrix-style technique of feeding information directly into your brain." And one of our favorite examples of terrible science news reporting had begun. Discovery News went with, "Novices download pilots' brainwaves, learn to fly." Most other outlets spoke of uploading information to the brain and learning in seconds. The one thing I was certain of as I read these headlines was that none of this was happening. Brain-machine interface technology is progressing rapidly, but we are a long way away from downloading information from or uploading information to the human brain. The news outlets reported that electrical activity was recorded from pilots and then used to stimulate the subject. They also reported that this enhanced learning by 33%. What actually happened? The study was titled "Transcranial Direct Current Stimulation Modulates Neuronal Activity and Learning in Pilot Training." There were 31 subjects in the study, divided into four groups. One group had transcranial direct current stimulation, TDCS, to the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, DLPFC, while a second had sham stimulation of this area. Sham stimulation creates the sensation of being stimulated but does not reach the brain. A third group had TDCS to the primary motor cortex, M1, and a fourth group had sham stimulation of M1. In prior studies, stimulation of DLPFC has been associated with increasing working memory. While this finding is still somewhat controversial, the studies so far are promising. Stimulation of M1 is meant to enhance the acquiring of motor skills, although this finding is less well established with prior research. The 31 subjects were trained on a flight simulator, and their performance was tracked. The question for the study was whether or not either type of stimulation would aid in learning this new and fairly complex task. Here is the main result for DLPFC stimulation. Neither the initial nor the final behavioral performance were significantly different between DLPFC stimulation and sham groups. The average trial duration to reach 2/3 back, a measure of accuracy on the task subjects were learning, was not significantly different between stimulation and sham groups. In addition, the average number of trials to reach 2/3 back and the average 2/3 back streak durations were not statistically different between groups. Significant differences in online, offline, and combined learning rates were not observed between stimulation and sham groups. What they did observe is that the variance for the stimulation groups was 33% less than for the sham groups. So there was less variability in performance, even though overall average performance was no different. The results for the M1 group were the same, no statistically significant difference in overall learning, and this time no difference in variance either. The researchers also took multiple measures of brain activity, looking for differences in the stimulation and sham groups. And there were some differences, but none that directly relate to actual learning. Journalism failure number one, turning a negative into a positive. Overall, this was a negative study. Stimulation of either brain region didn't improve learning in the subjects. The only effect was to reduce the variability in learning in the DLPFC stimulation, but not the M1 stimulation. Given the small size of this study and the number of variables they observed, it isn't a surprise that there would be a few statistically significant outcomes. These could easily be chance outcomes and shouldn't be considered reliable until they are replicated in larger studies. More interesting than the outcome of the study itself is how absolutely wrong the mainstream reporting was. There was never any downloading, or in fact any kind of recording made from pilots. Indeed, there are no pilots in this study. Further, the brain stimulation was standard, not based at all on activity recorded from pilots. Finally, the study was essentially negative. There was no improvement in learning in the stimulation group compared to the sham group. The reported 33% improvement was not an improvement, just a decrease in variability. Journalism failure number 2, stopping at the press release. This may be one of the most complete journalistic fails reporting a science news item I have ever seen. But in this case, it's the press release from HRL Laboratories that is largely to blame, not to suggest that the journalists are off the hook. The press release reports, Dr. Matthew Phillips and his team of investigators from HRL's Information and System Sciences Laboratory used transcranial direct current stimulation, TDCS, in order to improve learning and skill retention. We measured the brain activity patterns of 6 commercial and military pilots, and then transmitted these patterns into novice subjects as they learned to pilot an airplane in a realistic flight simulator, he says. I found this nowhere in the paper itself. The quote is likely taken out of context, but it's hard to imagine the context since it seems to have no relationship to the study. The press release also states, the study, published in the February 2016 issue of the journal Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, found that subjects who received brain stimulation via electrode-embedded headcaps improved their piloting abilities. This is true, but then so did the controls. Elsewhere, the press release says that stimulation modulates learning, not improves. It modulated learning only in the decrease in variance. However, then the press release states it outright. While previous research has demonstrated that TDCS can both help patients more quickly recover from a stroke and boost a healthy person's creativity, HRL's study is one of the first to show that TDCS is effective in accelerating practical learning. But learning was not accelerated. Conclusion, a press release is not a study. Using TDCS to alter brain function is an interesting area of research. This type of treatment may eventually play a role in recovery from stroke or other brain injury, but it's still too early to tell. The current study is small, with 31 subjects spread across 4 groups, and the researchers looked at many variables. This is clearly a preliminary study. One might say a, quote, pilot study, but not in the way the news reporting indicated, which is useful for guiding further research, but lacking the power and specificity to draw any firm conclusions. What the reporting of this study shows is the massive problem that exists in reporting science news items to the public. The press release and the reporting that flowed from that press release appear to have almost no correlation with the findings of the study itself. What seems to have happened is that the reporters hit upon a great sci-fi movie analogy, The Matrix. That was it, and that drove all the details of the reporting. They had no problem altering or just making up details as necessary to fit the sci-fi narrative. Chapter 50, Microbiomania. The passengers in our microbiome contain at least 4 million genes, and they work constantly on our behalf. They manufacture vitamins and patrol our guts to prevent infections. They help to form and bolster our immune systems and digest food. Michael Spector. Probiotics cure asthma. Fecal transplants treat schizophrenia. Improve your gut flora to prevent Alzheimer's. A cursory Google search of the word microbiome yields a wide variety of articles. Some are solid peer-reviewed studies. Others are popular media coverage of those peer-reviewed studies. And unfortunately, many are overhyped. Microbiome is defined as the aggregate genetic material of all the microorganisms within a particular system. For our purposes, we're discussing the human microbiome, the collective DNA of all the bugs living on us or in us at any given time. Between 10 trillion and 100 trillion microbial cells live symbiotically with our own, the vast majority being bacteria in our digestive tracts. Modern estimates show that for every native human cell, we've got a bacterial cell lurking. It's a rapidly growing area of research, and publication rates are high, especially when compared with the snail's pace of typical academic progress. Nearly every day, I come across a blog post or magazine article touting the wonders of our microscopic comrades. Some of the coverage is exceptional. I highly recommend Ed Yong's popular science book, I Contain Multitudes, for a thorough examination. But like many areas of scientific inquiry, with crossover appeal to the health and wellness crowd, microbiome research is a bright red target for pseudoscience, misuse, and reckless reporting. Credit where credit is due. Evolutionary microbiologist Jonathan Eisen has been policing the worst offenders for nearly a decade on his blog, The Tree of Life. He even gives out fake awards for the most egregious perpetrators of what he's dubbed microbiomania. He says, there are two ends to this. There's ridiculous stuff about why we should kill all microbes. That's the germophobia club. And then there's microbiomania, who think microbes are beneficial and do everything. Of course, the answer is somewhere in between. Discussions about good bacteria and bad bacteria are woefully simplistic. Often, the hype begins at the source, the very establishment undertaking the research, or a public relations firm working for the institution. University and industry press releases are notoriously aggrandizing, and it doesn't help that they're written like traditional news coverage. This is, of course, completely by design. If a journalist is tasked with an overwhelming number of assigned stories, they might be compelled to simply repackage pre-existing press releases to make their quota. It's incredibly common and, in my opinion, incredibly unethical. A good example of this type of hype is a 2016 paper published in Scientific Reports titled "Antibiotic-Induced Perturbations in Gut Microbial Diversity Influences Neuroinflammation and Amyloidosis in a Murine Model of Alzheimer's Disease." As pointed out by Dr. Eisen, the study shows nothing of the sort. Only a correlation can be drawn between changes in gut flora and neuroinflammation, amyloidosis, in the laboratory mice. Antibiotic usage may be influencing both, or perhaps an intermediary is at play, microbiota of the skin, nose or ears, or components of the blood. There may be a variable of which we are currently unaware. And then the press release is published. Antibiotics weaken Alzheimer's disease progression through changes in the gut microbiome, a grossly misleading title from the University of Chicago Medical Center, the very institution that undertook the research. Although the original paper and the associated press release make an attempt to caveat some of the claims made by the authors, you have to dig to find them. And these disclaimers are completely lost in translation as journalists do their own write-arounds. By the end of the game of science reporting telephone, we're left with articles like, "Antibiotics could be used to prevent Alzheimer's disease by changing gut bacteria," "Antibiotics might fight Alzheimer's plaques," and "Is popping antibiotics a way to beat Alzheimer's?" So some correlation between gut bacteria and inflammation turns into a prevention or cure for Alzheimer's disease. Then people wonder why all these promised breakthroughs never materialize. Poor reporting is one thing, but even more pernicious is the choice of some individuals to pass off agenda-driven, often fabricated rhetoric as true journalism. It's called pseudo-journalism, and it belies the basic ethical principles held near and dear by professional news workers. Such fake news is ubiquitous online, and microbiomania is a favorite topic of its most egregious offenders. Ever the popular wellness crank, Dr. Joseph Mercola is a great example of pseudo-journalism. He loves to tout the magical control the microbiome has over every aspect of human health. A cynical person might note that this microbiome hype plays nicely into the products he sells. According to articles on his website, your gut bacteria are responsible for obesity, diabetes, depression, autism, anxiety, schizophrenia, cancer, asthma, and arthritis, among other random ailments. The solution? Buy his book. He ends every article on human microbiota with a sales pitch for Fat for Fuel. It apparently contains secrets doctors don't want you to know about. With enough leafy greens, fermented vegetables, and probiotics, you too can prevent disease. Only $16.99, and it comes with 6 free gifts. And, no lie, Dr. Mercola recommends you stop showering for optimal microbial health. According to him, our overzealous hygiene is throwing our skin microbiota out of whack. He also claims that the only reason we stink when we don't wash our skin or hair, or wear deodorant, is because we currently keep too clean. And if we just stop altogether, eventually the smell goes away. I'm sure our co-workers would beg to differ. And if that weren't enough, he adds insult to injury by recommending bacterial sprays and probiotic soaps. The creator of one such spray, which contains friendly ammonia-oxidizing bacteria, hasn't showered in over a decade. Many of the red flags of pseudo-journalism in medical reporting are here. These red flags include hyped claims that sound fantastical. They typically offer simple solutions to either complex problems or many different problems simultaneously. They generally trade in conspiracy theories and distrust of mainstream sources and experts. They promise secret or suppressed information. And perhaps the biggest red flag, at the end of the day, there is always a sales pitch. It's difficult to top Mercola's kind of crazy, but if he has met his match in anyone, it's Deepak Chopra. His take on the human microbiome is nothing short of laughable. Skeptic and journalist Kavin Sinapathy says it best. What we know about microbiome is dwarfed by what we don't know, and Deepak Chopra takes liberties to fill in the gaps. And in January 2016, he did so in spectacular fashion. He actually claimed, in public no less, that our bacteria listen to our thoughts. At an online conference called the Fat Summit, a sort of who's who in health quackery, event host Mark Hyman interviewed Chopra. Hyman said, "I love yoga, and I do it, and I always feel transformed. And it's amazing that not only your genes are listening to your thoughts, but your microbiome, the bacteria, are listening to your thoughts." Chopra agreed, "Yeah, the bacterial genes are listening to your thoughts." I'll just leave that right there. Chapter 51, Reporting Epigenetics. One of the things about genetics that has become clearer as we've done genomes, as we've worked our way through the evolutionary tree, including humans, is that we're probably much more genetic animals than we want to confess we are. Craig Venter. Epigenetics is a recent science buzzword, which should make you very cautious when reading any popular reporting about it. The newer a scientific concept is, the easier it is to exploit for hyped gee-whiz reporting. Even sincere science journalists can be taken in, if they aren't careful to put the new concept into context and really check their understanding. For example, reporting in The Advertiser, an Australian news outlet, Brad Crouch gives a fairly dramatic example of some common tropes of bad science reporting. Crouch's byline says he is a, quote, medical reporter, so we really should know better. Crouch is reporting in 2014 on a review article on epigenetics recently published in Science. It's honestly difficult to see how Crouch got from the review article on which he is ostensibly reporting to his news article. He begins, "Landmark Adelaide research showing that sperm and eggs appear to carry genetic memories of events well before conception may force a rethink of the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin," scientists say. Reporters love to suggest that new findings threaten to overturn established science, especially if they can invoke a recognizable name like Darwin. Crouch also goes on to say that perhaps this research supports Lamarck's theory of evolution rather than Darwinian natural selection. First, the paper is not research, let alone landmark research. It is a review article. It's not even a systematic review or a meta-analysis, which a reporter might be forgiven for calling a, quote, study. It's just a discussion of the topic of epigenetics. That's journalism fail number one, failing to properly identify what kind of paper is being reported on, new research, a review, or opinion. What is especially interesting is that the words evolutionary theory, Darwin, and Lamarck appear nowhere in the paper, despite being the focus of Crouch's review article. Here is what the review actually says. Transgenerational epigenetic effects interact with conditions at conception to program the developmental trajectory of the embryo and fetus, ultimately affecting the lifetime health of the child. These insights compel us to revise generally held notions to accommodate the prospect that biological parenting commences well before birth, even prior to conception. Essentially, epigenetics are tweaks to the expression of genes in response to environmental factors. If a mother is, for example, living in times when there is good access to food, epigenetic factors will adapt her children to the current abundance. If she is living in lean times, they will be more adapted to food scarcity. One biochemical mechanism of epigenetic factors that has been discovered is methylation of base pairs, the fundamental units of DNA. This doesn't affect the sequence of genes, but it can affect their expression. While epigenetics is still fairly new, and the details are yet to be worked out, the experiments so far show that it's a short-term, one or a few generations, tweak to adapt to immediate conditions, and it doesn't have any real impact on Darwinian evolution. It certainly does not indicate that the inheritance of acquired characteristics, often referred to as Lamarckism, even though this notion did not originate with Lamarck, was not unique to Lamarck, and was actually a minor aspect of Lamarck's evolutionary thinking, will now replace Darwinian evolution. I am not even sure I buy the much more limited conclusion of the review that healthful lifestyles are transmitted to children. This seems like an awful lot of extrapolation from limited research. It is plausible and consistent with existing research that being obese or overeating during pregnancy may cause an epigenetic signal of abundance, leading to children with a greater than average tendency to put on weight. What isn't clear is if this is clinically relevant in humans. I also wouldn't generalize this to healthful lifestyle. As the article continues, Crouch goes way beyond overcalling epigenetics and takes a left turn into bizarro world. It paves the way for a review of the work of French biologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, whose theory that an organism can pass to its offspring characteristics acquired during its lifetime was largely ignored after Darwin's publication of On the Origin of Species in the mid-1800s. That work defining evolution as a process of incidental random mutation between generations. Wrong. This wasn't Lamarck's theory, but worse still, epigenetics has absolutely nothing to do with the mechanisms of evolutionary change. Crouch does then pivot to the actual subject of the review, the effect of parental habits on the child. He quotes one of the authors, Sarah Robertson. People used to think that it didn't matter because a child represented a new beginning with a fresh start, she said. The reality is, we can now say with great certainty, the child doesn't quite start from scratch. They already carry over a legacy of factors from their parents' experiences that can shape development in the fetus and after birth. There is now biological evidence that memories of experiences in adults can be transferred through egg and sperm for the lifetime prospects of the child. If evolution has developed something like this, it can give a child an edge to survive. This will rewrite long-held views that experiences can actually be transferred to offspring. You will notice that Robertson never says anything to support either the notion that epigenetics calls Darwinian evolution into question or the hyped interpretation that lifestyle transfers to children. Everything she says is compatible with a conservative interpretation of epigenetics. Here we have journalism failure number two, relying on, quote, common knowledge about complex scientific topics. In this case, Crouch is discussing the review article in the context of what is essentially a myth about Lamarck. He didn't check his background assumptions. Journalism failure number three is falling for a common science reporting trope, hyping how much a new idea or finding contradicts an established